Cyber Frontier, bringing you the latest news on the local Colorado economy and initiatives that focus on the development of cybersecurity economics. You don't have to be a computer or cybersecurity expert to get plugged in. Your host, Chris Gorog, brings it straightforward, asks the tough questions, and brings the cyber world to a level of understanding for everyone. Chris is personable and opens up with our guests on the issues we all would like to see addressed. You can find us on the web at www.newcyberfrontier.com. Now join our host as he introduces the topic for today's New Cyber Frontier.
So welcome. Today we have with us a special guest. We are at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Golden, Colorado, and we have Erfan Ibrahim, and he is the Center Director for Cyber, Physical, Security, and Resilience here at NREL. So welcome today, Erfan.
Thank you.
How are you?
I'm doing just fine.
And we were joking before we started, we got past the name part, so I think we're all good now. Everything's smooth
yes.
and clear. So, Erfan, give us a background of how you got to be where you're at and what you do here at NREL.
A little bit on my background. I studied physics in undergrad, and then I went into a nuclear focus. My master's degree was in mechanical engineering with a focus on fusion, and then a PhD in nuclear engineering in plasma physics, applied plasma physics, nuclear fusion engineering, looking at different designs for fusion. So I have a solid energy background from my undergrad and graduate study. And then I moved into information technology in the mid-90s and got a lot of hands-on experience working in the telecom industry. I was working for Pacific Bell, and I personally managed the Western backbone of the internet in the mid-90s. So I transitioned from energy to information technology and telecom, and for the last 20 years have been addressing different aspects of that subject, from communications, wireless and wired both, as well as network management, cybersecurity. And then about 8 years ago, I re-entered the energy field working for the Electric Power Research Institute. I led their smart meter program and cybersecurity program for 4 years. And that is where I really got to know the electric sector and got to know many of the utilities and independent power producers, as well as vendors, trade associations, and academia who are working in this smart grid field. And then two contributions that I made to the industry. One was the NIST roadmap, the Smart Grid Interoperability Roadmap Project, where I was tasked to build the consensus in the industry on which standards to use. So I put together the first workshops for NIST while I was at EPRI that started this whole roadmap project in 2009. Got to know many of the stakeholders. And then in 2010, we were awarded the NESCOR project from DOE, which is the National Electric Sector Cybersecurity Organization Resources Project. And that was to develop standards for cybersecurity that would go into smart grid, all aspects of it, from distributed energy resources to transmission and distribution to electric vehicles and so on. So I got, again, hands-on experience working with the different stakeholders to accelerate the adoption of standards so that we could have a more secure electric grid as well as the customer prem that was now getting integrated to the grid. So with that background, I went into consulting for a few years, helped academia and trade associations and companies and utilities until I was given this job to run the cybersecurity center here at NREL. My boss, Brian Hennigan, is also a former EPRI person, so that's how I got to know him and had a lot of respect for the work he was doing at EPRI. And then he shared with me what was going on here at the Energy Systems Integration Directorate. Sounded very exciting. So NREL actually established a new center with my hiring. So I'm the first director of the center. And through a lab-directed R&D opportunity and a strategic initiative opportunity, I was able to put together a team, a program, and have the interface now with industry stakeholders. And I must say that after 15 months of being here, I'm really proud that we have a complete cybersecurity testbed with power systems, communications, and cybersecurity. We also have a program with R&D services that we are offering to a variety of verticals, and we have a really good team of people with very diverse backgrounds. So I'm quite gratified that I was given this opportunity, and now it's time for us to take this to market, and that's what we're doing.
Yeah, it's an amazing facility here, and a pretty new building here that they put up for that. Quite a bit of square footage and a lot of programs you're pulling in and looking for more in the process.
So a little bit on the Energy Systems Integration Directorate, because I think it's very important to understand the distinction of this particular directorate relative to other programs at NREL. This program is all about applied engineering. Mm-hmm. Because we recognize that while there have been a lot of advances in renewable energy, whether it be solar or wind or biofuels or hydrogen or others, the challenge in the market is how to integrate these with the existing infrastructure. And that cannot be done with a paper exercise. Mm-hmm. You cannot just wish it. You have to actually experiment with it and then prove that you can do it in a safe, reliable, and cost-effective manner. And a lot of the research that goes on here at the Energy Systems Integration Facility, ESIF, is to test out these integrations and work out the kinks so that when these technologies go into the market, they already have recipes of integration ready so that their adoption can be accelerated and not keep repeating those mistakes of systems integration. The other area of the ESI, the Energy Systems Integration, is looking beyond the electric sector, because we recognize that there are synergies mm-hmm. between the electric sector, the water sector, oil and gas, and thermal systems. So our definition at ESI is broader than just electric when we talk about ESI. So we're looking at the nexus of electricity and water, for instance, or oil and gas and water and electricity, or how thermal systems work with water and electricity, and so on. So we have a much broader concept of energy when we talk about energy systems.
We'll be right back with the rest of today's show right after these brief messages from our sponsors. Cyber Resilience Institute helps build strong cyber communities designed to prevent members from attack. Like building a neighborhood watch, it takes coordination and a sharing community to protect our identities and valuables in the virtual world. Typically, we hear that organizations know they need to do something to protect their cyber assets, but don't know where to begin. Let Cyber Resilience Institute help your community create an action plan. Cyber Resilience Institute will build your community or business marketplace so that it is designed to support a collective cyber defense. Contact them for more information at cyberresilienceinstitute.org.
So beyond energy, you had said that, you know, in the past you ran a lot of the IT infrastructure, the internet in the West, and you cross with energy systems. So you're a great resource to kind of ask this, because a lot of the focus is on government cyber, information security, and even this Colorado effort, most of the people I've interviewed have come entirely from this government information security background, and that's really all we hear over and over again. So as far as you talked about your mission being almost on the polar opposite side of that, energy systems and everything, what do you think about that connecting those two, and how can that be done under, you know, this effort?
Well, the first thing to observe is that the telecom sector, healthcare, financial services, I would say are at least a decade ahead of all of this energy sector in terms of communication infrastructure and cybersecurity controls. Mm-hmm. And the main reason for that is because the business applications that were being supported in the other verticals needed that. They needed high availability. They needed cybersecurity, because breaches would be very expensive. So the urgency was there. You see that with healthcare, with HIPAA, You see that in the financial sector with Sarbanes-Oxley. So there are these policy things that now necessitate certain controls. With credit card, there's PCI. There's a standard way in which, whether you have an ATM card or a credit card, how that will be transacted. Not so much in the electric sector and the water sector. It used to be much more proprietary. You had vendor-specific applications. They had their own security controls, and they were kind of siloed. But it was okay because they were vertically integrated. Mm-hmm. But you see now in the energy sector, whether you look at not so much water yet, but definitely with electricity, the deregulation that has happened, that the same asset owner, the utility, is now broken up into different companies, generation, transmission, and distribution. You have an influx of a lot of independent power producers in the market. So you cannot just rely on proprietary protocols and vendor-specific applications. You have to develop some industry-wide standards for how data is exchanged in a secure and reliable way. So we are seeing in the energy sector, the broader concept, the same demands are being put on it that were put on telecom, healthcare, and financial services. So I see a tremendous opportunity for the energy sector to learn from these other sectors that are, as I said, about a decade ahead. Mm-hmm. But as you translate those controls, you have to think about your specific applications and put the controls that are relevant to them. You can't just do a copy and paste, as many have tried. So the challenge that we have in the energy sector today is it one of skill set, that we have a lot of people that have that IT-centric view of cybersecurity, and they're just trying to put it directly on the energy side simply because we're migrating to the internet protocol, the IP protocol. Mm-hmm. And they say, well, since it's IP over there and IP over here, we can just bring all those controls over. Not so. The other verticals, healthcare, telecom, financial services, all operate from a data center-centric way of mm-hmm. looking at things, where you have a set of assets that are sitting in sealed buildings with a lot of physical security around them. It's different in the energy sector, where a lot of the assets are out in the open, where hackers have access, physical access to those devices. So the cybersecurity posture is very different. The kind of controls you will need are going to be different. So while you can learn a lot from the technologies of healthcare and financial services and telecom because they're ahead of the curve, but you still have to think about use cases in the energy sector and the specific controls you'll put to secure these use cases. You can't just transfer those controls over from the IT side because of the physical layout being different.
So, and we have seen, I've seen the same thing with just the majority of the knowledge in cyber comes from information security, securing the data. Yeah. How can we start to bridge this gap that we're, you know, I talk about a lot and I hear you saying the same thing, to get, you know, do we need to address this to information security people? Do we need to just train more people to understand the energy systems cyber? Do we need to address, you know, the business aspect? How do we get that information and that mindset or knowledge base to shift?
So workforce development is a critical aspect of this. And the way I see it is that power systems folks or water systems folks or thermal systems folks who understand their applications well need to learn cybersecurity. Mm-hmm. That would be much easier than taking IT cybersecurity people and trying to teach them these applications, because it would require them to go back to school and study the engineering that's involved in running electrical systems and water systems and thermal systems. That would be too difficult. But if these IT security people could act as mentors to the power systems and water systems people and educate them on what it takes to secure applications, then they can think of the particular version of those controls that would work for their application because they have the domain expertise. Mm-hmm. They understand timescales. They understand that if you burden a system with too many security controls and the latency exceeds a certain value and it starts timing out, that makes the application unavailable. So while it's secure, it's also unavailable, which is a form of insecurity. Mm-hmm. So we need that knowledge transfer for sure. The second thing we need is we need to learn the lessons from the IT side and not repeat the mistakes on the operational technology side. For instance, we have learned from healthcare, telecom, financial services that it's a good thing to segment your network. It's a good thing to have role-based access control. It's a good thing to have sophisticated usernames and passwords. It's a good thing to encrypt certain pieces of information that require confidentiality. And it's a good thing to size your systems correctly so that you don't have unnecessary latency added to the transit time of bits.
But that one seems to be an energy systems requirement that really doesn't exist over on the other side in IT.
It does.
Latency problem.
The latency problem does exist on the IT side when you have multi-hop networks and geographically distributed networks.
So if talking it's telecom all type yes. of things where you have yes. or even voice communications that have to get from here to New York in a constant
That's correct. Or in
fashion.
Healthcare, for instance, imagine a surgeon is performing an operation and they quickly need to see an MRI mm-hmm. while the patient is open on the table. Imagine if there was latency on the network and this MRI was coming from another one.
But latency is different from machine to machine talking, when we're talking nanoseconds, to yes. human latency is less than a second. And you Correct. Know, if you're 0.2 seconds or 0.8 seconds, a human doesn't know the difference.
Correct.
But to a machine, that's an eternity.
Yes. So what I'm talking about is this additive latency that occurs. The transit time is the least of it. Mm-hmm. If you size your network correctly with bandwidth, the transit time is short. Most of the problem is in the processing time at the nodes. And for that, you need to have appropriate capacity planning of the systems that are on the either end of those, you know, the links. Mm-hmm. And that is where I find a lot of the latency occurs, with not having enough buffer, having buffer overflows, or having queue drops occurring because too much data came through the pipe and the system couldn't process it to send it to the next hop. Mm-hmm. So these are issues. Or at the end servers, having enough memory in them, having enough processing capability so it doesn't act as the bottleneck. Mm-hmm. So what I'm talking about is an architectural approach to designing networks that has that holistic, systemic view.
Gotcha.
Because
and adding cybersecurity into it.
Yes. And looking at cybersecurity, not just about encryption and about passwords, but also focusing on data integrity and the availability of data, because those are two of the three aspects of cybersecurity. Confidentiality is only one prong. Integrity and availability are two other prongs. And if you want to go a little further, accountability and reliability also. Mm-hmm. So those have to do with physical infrastructure, very little to do with encryption and authentication and authorization. So part of this is also breaking mental models. Mm-hmm. A lot of people, when you tell them cybersecurity, they think of username and password or encryption. That's a very small part of cybersecurity. And that is a very IT-centric view of cybersecurity.
But right now, if you think, sounds like you want to design a new system. And IT InfoSec people say, okay, that's good, go design a new system. But we need to do something right now. And that, to me, means putting up firewalls, monitoring traffic, which, you know, I've heard equated this whole model of we're just going to monitor traffic and make a big data analysis of what's going on with cyber. I've heard this equated to dumping a cup of coffee into a swimming pool and trying to get it out later. But this is the mind stay, the main thing that is thought of when we 95% of the training in cybersecurity at universities is InfoSec and is based on monitoring traffic and collecting big amounts of it and then doing something with it after the fact. So what do you say to the people that say, well, this is all we can do right now. Go design your system and come back when you have something, which is what I see as this kind of divide here we're talking about.
So I think we can make incremental improvements right away. And the way you do that is you start overlaying on this mixture of legacy and modern systems, a set of security controls from third-party products that are dedicated to doing specific things, whether it's intrusion detection or whether it's inline blocking. And then over time, the protocols and the end devices will have more security controls as they're modernized. Mm-hmm. But you can't expect a forklift upgrade day one.
Yeah.
Energy systems have old and new. The new ones may have the memory and processing capability to handle some of the new security controls coming out of NIST 7628 or from the NIST framework or from the ESC2M2. But the challenge is that many of the legacy systems that still have useful life left in them cannot handle that. Mm-hmm. So for a while, I see a transition period in which a lot of security is going to be offered systemically. And that's a big part of our research work here at NREL, where we're demonstrating that you can take a combination of legacy and modern systems and secure them today by the systemic security of inline blocking and intrusion detection. Yes, you put firewalls. Yes, you segment the network. Yes, you put restrictive access control lists that doesn't allow traffic to freely move from one VLAN to another VLAN. So all of those things are good. They're hardening the system. But eventually, for the unknown threats, you got to monitor. And once you monitor and you see anomalous behavior happening at the pipe level, I'm not talking at a macro level with some crunching going on, just mm-hmm. each pipe a la carte, you have to quiet down the network to the point where every transaction is needed. And if it's not needed, it's not happening on the network. That's what I refer to as quietening down the network. Our networks today are very noisy. And the reason why they're noisy is because of Moore's Law.
Exponential growth of data.
Exactly. We can't resist mm-hmm. the temptation to shove lots of bits because the pipe can handle it. Well, just because the pipe can handle it doesn't mean we have to fill it up. We have to be very, very specific about transactions. It's only a quiet network where anomalous behavior is easily visible. Mm-hmm. So if you want to do effective intrusion detection, you can't have a noisy network. So that means segmentation of networks is how you quiet it down, when you avoid broadcast storms, when you only move data on a need-to-know basis. Then, and by the way, this doesn't require any modernizing of any system. It just requires your communication network, that's IP-based network, to have the right policies. Set it up in the right configuration on your switches and routers. Mm-hmm. This is not rocket science. The firewall policies of role-based access control, that if you're coming in on a VPN based on your login credentials, you should be allowed to go in certain places and not others. Mm-hmm. Why is this concept of trusted versus untrusted? This is so naive. This is like a 20th century mindset that, you know, we are the good guys, the bad guys are out there, and once I've authenticated you and consider you a good guy, you can have access to anything you want. This is naive. Mm-hmm. Today, in our modern world, the inside threat is greater than the outside threat. And the reason is because of mergers and acquisitions, companies are owned by people who we don't know. I mean, you have to really look into their books to find out who the parent company is. Think of that from a cybersecurity perspective. What if a nefarious entity started offering cloud services to enterprise accounts? And people start thinking, oh, it's cheaper to go to the cloud. I don't have to run my servers here. Do they check to see who the parent company is of that cloud company? It may have a U.S. address. It may even have legitimate people who used to work in the government before, but they don't even know who the parent company is. So there is a real challenge today with this migration to the cloud and this interconnectedness that we are losing that sense of, and you've done this in your former work, I believe at Deloitte with supply chain risk management, that you have to go all the way back to the roots of things to find out where the vulnerabilities lie. Mm-hmm. And I think that the best thing to do in this scenario is to limit the scope and limit the people that have access to specific data assets.
So do you think this is more of a business practice on controlling certain aspects about the companies, almost from a political stance, And that organization needs to start from the top end, while what we're talking about on the other end, from the technical design up, and they come together somewhere in the middle.
That's correct. Yes. From bottom up, you build immunity through these best practices that I talked about. Sophisticated usernames and passwords.
Mm-hmm.
Network segmentation. Restrictive access control lists on the routers and switches. And the active monitoring, that's context-based intrusion detection, not just signature-based. The challenge today is that we have a lot of IT-centric IDS systems, intrusion detection system. What they do is they're constantly out there looking for signatures for malware from various resources on the internet. And they're comparing to see if any of the traffic that's going through their pipe matches with that signature. And if it does, they flag. But the advanced persistent threat today is not using malware necessarily. They may use malware initially to create a hook to get in.
Mm-hmm.
But once they're in and they're the insider threat, they manipulate transactions with bogus values to throw off the state of systems. There's no malware signature for that. You have to understand the context of the protocols to be able to say that this is anomalous behavior. The expected value was to be in this range and it's out of the range. Who's going to check that from an IT side? They don't even know the protocol.
Mm-hmm.
How are they going to know that this is a bogus value? So the threat is becoming more sophisticated, and I feel that there's a need for that next generation of IDS systems to come into this mixture of legacy and modern systems to police the protocol. That way, you don't put too much pressure on the protocol itself to have security controls.
Mm-hmm.
You don't put pressure on the end systems to have security controls. You monitor by context and flag anomalous behavior at that protocol, at that application level, at the end user level, to say this individual doesn't have a right to do this command at this hour,
okay,
and therefore I'll flag it.
So, you know, we're getting a little very technical here in this end, but we basically said there, you know, there's two approaches. There's this technical bottoms up, and then there's the political. So if we're looking at organizing an effort here in Colorado, we're talking about this quite extensively, what steps would you give the policymakers to start with? And, you know, how long do you think it takes to get to certain...
So the first step I would take from the top level is to remove cybersecurity from being a line item in the IT budget. Cybersecurity is no longer the privy of IT. Cybersecurity today is akin to brand recognition.
How much do we spend on it, though? This is a big question. Maybe we can address this separately, because how much should they spend on it? How much should a government? How much should a company? Is a very tough question.
If you assign a value to how much you should spend on cybersecurity, you're putting the cart before the horse. You have to first understand what is the strategic value of your data assets to your enterprise. And based on that, do a proper risk assessment that if there's a probability that this data will be taken away, what will its cost be to my enterprise?
So is that the first step from the political side?
Yes.
Okay.
You have to do analysis of your business use cases to see what breach of data would create, and based on that, make the appropriate investments. It has to be risk-based. Otherwise, you could spend exorbitant amounts of money on cybersecurity, not get any security, and still be breached. Or you may end up not spending enough because you haven't quantified the risk. So the way you quantify risk is through the empirical approach. You build systems in the experimental phase, test them, and based on that, then extrapolate to the larger enterprise and say, if I don't put these controls, I know for sure I'm going to breach. I'm going to have a breach, either because I can do it, so someone else from outside could do it too. So I don't believe in these paper exercises where risk assessment is done by pulling a number out of the air. It needs to be
totally
empirically
qualitative.
Validated. Yes. So you have to have that top-down and bottom-up, what I call the hybrid approach, that you inform the policymakers at the enterprise level with empirical results. And that is the scientific method that has to occur. I see, largely in enterprises today, the top-down happening in the absence of empirical validation. And from the bottom up, You have technically savvy people looking for new toys constantly without the business rationale for why they need it. Mm-hmm. So the CFO is confused. They're like, I'm getting mixed signals. My colleagues at the business level are telling me I just need to do a bunch of paper exercise. But bottom up person says, I need this idea system and I need this firewall and I need this.
And the dollar signs on those don't match.
Yeah. So in order to do this, you have to have the hybrid approach. Start with the business. Look at what is at risk. Design an experiment and validate that the risk is real. And then fund it to secure your enterprise.
It sounds like a lot of steps, though, to determine what funding is. And I've seen the industry struggle with this for so many years that they never get the writing the check.
Right. So the first step you do is you do basic hygiene, which doesn't cost money. And all the controls that I spoke about, the username and password, the segmentation, the proper policies, don't require a lot of money. But I will challenge you. You go to the enterprises today and see how little of that is being implemented, how noisy the networks are, how IT-centric the IDS systems are, even though they're on the operational side. Then you begin to see that we're trying to solve a problem where basic stuff hasn't been done. So let's first do the things that don't cost a lot of money, that quickly secure or build immunity, and then do the refinements with more sophisticated tools.
Okay. So let's take a step up again to the program. The state's organizing a program. Many companies are involved. You know, they've identified training, research and development, and emergency response for cyber. Any recommendations to how that program pulls together?
Yes. I would say that there should be a certificate program in critical infrastructure security. And every enterprise that has any assets that involve operational technology should have at least two or more people who have that certificate. In the same way you go through CPR learning if you want to be a community emergency response team person or bone setting or fire quenching, the Department of Homeland Security has a program. And you go, you spend a couple of days, and you learn how to do that to be an emergency responder. Why is it that when it comes to cybersecurity, we have no standard certificate program for critical infrastructure security where these things are taught?
So who should head that up? Is that a government? Is that a company?
I would say that it should be a public-private partnership. I think it should be offered at community colleges, and it should be subsidized by the federal government. And companies should sponsor it, and you know they can put up
so
their
little...
So do
you see that as an NREL piece that you could be involved with, or is that not quite your
mission? So this consortium that you are a part of could be a very good place to incubate this.
That's actually one of the plans here. We don't talk a lot about that at this point, but definitely that public-private partnership is what the Cyber Resilience Institute is about.
And I think community college is just the right venue for it because if people come out of high school, they can easily get a vocational degree in this area. They don't need to go through 4 years of college, and they can start helping populate the companies with this expertise.
That's a good question, because there's been a lot of question now when I say that they've organized this Colorado effort in the training, research development, and emergency response. And they're focusing first on training, because like a lot of the companies are realizing, you don't need a full four-year degree. We want somebody maybe even like a vocational technical type of training. Where do you see that your needs here for what you're doing in energy systems, where are your best candidates coming from, and what type of training do they have?
Most of them are coming from two types of electrical engineering programs, one that's power systems focused and one that's focused on network communications and security. Mm-hmm. And I find the sweet spot in the upper 2 years of the undergraduate curriculum.
Do you take a lot of people that are directly from college, or do you look for more utility experience for a couple of years?
No, more from college. It's easier to form them.
Okay. So, energy system programs, you say you get both of those. Would a combined program be a good thing for energy systems and IT security?
Or? I don't think you can teach it. There is no university where you can teach what I do here at the center. It's just you can teach them conceptual stuff, and I think that's great. And that's why we're going to have four interns here this summer. Two of them are going to come from power systems programs. I think they're starting next week. And two of them are coming from network communications and security. Trust me, by the time they leave, they would have cross-trained each other significantly. Mm-hmm. They'll each have an appreciation of what the other is up to. But unfortunately, the way our undergraduate curriculum is set up in this country, you learn things a la carte.
Yeah, I know that exactly. Like I took my undergraduate was in computer engineering. I had half the courses with electrical engineers and half it with computer science instructors. And I would ask continuously how the two were connected. And on both sides, I didn't get a clear answer for 4 years.
Just to give you an idea, I have never taken an information technology class in my life. I have no certificate. I have no formal education in this field. And I'm running this center. Mm-hmm. And I can do research in this center. So that will show you how much you can learn on the job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's definitely and that's the first.
I mean, yes, I'm a problem solver. I've learned how
and
to break
to
a problem
to get
down
to the level
and address
you're at.
It. But what I'm saying, and I'm not trying to undervalue university education. I think it's really good to teach you the concepts. But if you want to synthesize the concepts and solve real problems in the world, you have to come into the workforce to see it. No amount of book training can give you that. And that's my challenge, that a lot of the cybersecurity expertise that exists in our sector has come from book learning. Mm-hmm. They pass an exam, multiple choice, based on a 500-page book that has a set of security controls. And if they learn the language, they pass it. We've seen this in other fields also, in IT, for instance, where people got certificates from established companies, but they couldn't even configure a server after they got the certificate. And so then they said, oh, we got to have a lab portion to this program. Because that's what you do when you get these IT certificates, is you end up managing servers in data centers. So I feel that if we really want to get a fast acceleration going in securing critical infrastructure, let's keep our focus on critical infrastructure. That's water, electricity, oil and gas infrastructure, wastewater, things that will affect quality of life of large numbers of people if something were to happen. That to me is critical infrastructure. Transportation is critical infrastructure, also aviation. But they all have a SCADA in them, supervisory control and data acquisition. So securing that SCADA is important. It architecturally, the solutions for securing SCADA are very similar across all these verticals. They all involve a central server and an HMI, a human-machine interface, some kind of merge unit, and sensors, or PLCs, or RTUs out in the field. Take whatever vertical, you'll always see this three-tier architecture for SCADA. Securing it is very similar. The particulars may be different. The objects that are being exchanged are different based on the vertical. But the best practices for securing this three-tier architecture that's geographically distributed out in the field, but all sitting in one control center somewhere, is very similar. Mm-hmm. So if we could have a vocational training program that had affiliation with real companies, real national labs, I think within 2 years after high school, you could get people at pretty high levels of skill. Now, when they are combined with the book smart people out of bachelor's and master's and PhD, then you've got a nice combination to solve the problem. Because you got the concept and you got the practice. Someone who's ready to roll up their sleeves, get underneath that server rack, and puts real stuff.
Where the rubber meets the road.
Yes.
Yeah. So we could talk about this all day, but kind of in pulling a close on this talk, what kind of advice would you give the leadership organizing the Colorado effort? We have the chance to go from the ground up. You've been involved with the Electrical Power Research Institute, NIST, SGIP. What advice would you give them to get this effort started?
The first advice I would give them is to calm down and relax. And not get too hyper about the current situation. yes, our infrastructure is vulnerable. It is vulnerable primarily because we threw a bunch of technology at it that's highly internetworked. It's like the perfect storm, right? We have opened up a lot of new attack surfaces. The variety of hackers has proliferated because of that highly internetworked global footprint. We have a lot of programmable logical controllers and remote terminal units of critical infrastructure with public IP addresses sitting out there. You can just use the Shodan utility and you will see how many of them are sitting there. So yes, the situation is dire because primarily because we were too good at it. We threw too much technology on it. But it doesn't mean we have to get hyper and go irrational and just waste a lot of money and throw it at stuff without solving the problem. We need to use a systems engineering approach to solving this problem, which means break it down. Look at the use cases that are important that are generating revenue. Look at the architecture of the infrastructure supporting those business use cases, and over time, put the appropriate controls. You are never going to be completely secure, but you can reduce your threat vector significantly by improving your business processes, by having the right policies at the enterprise level or at the state or federal level. And you need to educate your people to be more cybersecurity aware. The best cybersecurity technologies is not going to secure if people leave their passwords and usernames on their desktops, or they go drink from a water fountain and leave their screens unlocked. No amount of technology is going to fix that. The insider threat is becoming more and more credible and serious, and we need to stop thinking about security from a trust versus untrusted to a more context-based, like, I don't care who you are. If you're going to do something wrong, I'm going to stop you. Mm-hmm. And if our leadership in enterprises and in the government were to calm down, use the systems engineering approach, put the basic controls in place, invest money in the training of people, the situation will improve significantly.
Okay. Well, thank you for being on today. We definitely had a lot covered here and got a lot of great information there from.
I appreciate the opportunity, Chris. Thank you.
Sure. Have a great day.
Thank you.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of New Cyber Frontier. Remember to get involved. Often we think that someone else will handle privacy and security in the virtual world, but you are the only one truly in command of your virtual fate. Join our mailing list so we can keep you informed of breaking news and new releases. If you have an idea, if you have a question that you would like to hear answered, or if you want to get involved with our efforts, reach out to us at newcyberfrontier.com. We also encourage you to visit our sponsors' links, as they are the ones that really make this show possible. I want to thank each of you for supporting the show, and we look forward to seeing you back for the next episode of New Cyber Frontier.